From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is off today. Sam Fussell was a gawky-looking guy, but that was before he walked into a local bodybuilding gym. 4 years later, he was a champion bodybuilder who not only altered his appearance, but his psyche as well. On this edition of Fresh Air, the confessions of an unlikely bodybuilder. Also today, we talk food with Jeff Weinstein, the food critic for The Village Voice. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the work of some current saxophone quartets. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has begun debate on a campaign finance reform bill, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Campaign finance reform is one of the most difficult issues for Congress. Attempts to fix the process by which lawmakers raise money to get reelected have failed for years. Each party wants to protect its own sources of funds. This year, the Democrats have introduced a law that would ban political action committee contributions and restrict so-called soft money contributions by state parties. The most controversial aspect of their bill would set spending limits for each state based on population. Candidates would be given an incentive, vouchers for political advertising, to encourage them to accept the spending limits. The Republican alternative would also ban PACs, but would not impose spending limits. Republicans argue that challengers, who are more often Republicans, need to be able to raise as much money as possible in order to overcome the financial advantages of incumbents, who are more often Democrats. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Yugoslavia faces a power vacuum at the top as the heads of the country's two biggest republics failed to agree on a leader for the collective federal presidency. The post was supposed to have been filled by a Croatian as part of an annual rotation agreement. The Croatian candidate, Stipe Mesic, would have been the first non-communist to lead the presidency. Mesic was blocked by the communist leaders of Serbia, Croatia's major rival. The presidential committee is scheduled to meet again tomorrow, but Croatia's president has said that the republic may secede from the federation if its candidate is not accepted. In Peru, the long-awaited United States-Peruvian drug agreement has finally been signed. The negotiations lasted 6 months and were conducted in secret. The lack of public debate was a sore point for many Peruvian political leaders, as Mike DeMott reports from Lima.
The U.S.-Peruvian drug agreement has few specific details. Instead, it gives broad outlines for reducing coca production through economic development and for fighting drug traffickers with police action. To work out concrete strategies, the agreement calls for forming a bilateral association of U.S. and Peruvian officials at the highest levels in each government. The association is to be formed within 6 months. It will attempt to reduce the supply and demand of illegal drugs, both in the United States and in Peru. Peru is the world's largest producer of coca, and the United States is the biggest consumer of coca-based drugs like cocaine and crack. Some congressmen criticized the lack of public debate on the drug agreement. But President Fujimori said prior consultations were impossible because during the negotiations, an agreement still didn't exist. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike DeMott in Lima.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 21 points to close at 2,865.38. Declines led advances by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 190 million shares. This is NPR News. The Senate urged President Bush today to approve the sale of as much as $1.5 billion worth of American grain and other foods to the Soviet Union. The president has indicated that he's concerned that the Soviets may not be creditworthy for the deal, but he said he wants to help Soviet President Gorbachev. Today's Senate resolution urged the president to approve the sale on condition that the food would not be withheld from the Baltics or other Soviet republics. Senators have said they want to be sure that the central government can't use the food to exert control over the republics. U.S. Secretary of State James Baker held 4 more hours of talks with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir today. Baker may send a personal envoy to Jordan for more discussions. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
After today's talks, Israel's prime minister and the foreign and defense ministers are trying to put together a document outlining the areas of agreement with the U.S. Depending on what that document says, Secretary Baker may hold another meeting with Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir tonight. Israel Radio reported that Baker may also send a personal envoy for further talks with King Hussein if he sees any movement on the Israeli side. Baker was expected to try to bridge the gap between Israel and Syria by asking Israel to accept a representative from the UN Secretary General as an observer. Baker would like to announce that the parties have agreed to attend an opening session of a regional peace conference next month, even as Syria says it won't come. But Israeli analysts say it's more likely that Baker will leave the region tomorrow without an agreement. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A Senate panel heard testimony today on the huge pay packages collected by the nation's top corporate executives. Shareholders' rights advocates claim that top executive compensation reflects a growing gap between shareholders and corporate chiefs. An expert on corporate compensation told the panel that the average top executive earned 53 times the pay of the company's average worker. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Sam Fussell was a short, skinny kid who, when adolescence hit, became a tall and skinny teenager. He was a bookish student. He graduated with honors from Oxford University with a degree in English literature. His parents are intellectuals. His father, Paul Fussell, is a noted literary critic, and his mother, Betty Fussell, is a writer. Sam Fussell grew up in a world that valued intellect over athletics. When he graduated from college and left the protected walls of academia, he moved to New York City and became consumed by his fears of urban life. What he did to make himself feel invulnerable was become a bodybuilder. He spent 4 years, 4 hours a day, 6 days a week, pumping iron. He turned himself into a larger-than-life muscle man and nearly killed himself in the process. Fussell's written a memoir about those obsessive years called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. When we spoke, I asked him what made him so unlikely.
How many 6'4", 250-pound, Oxford-educated, steroid-addicted bodybuilders do you know who live next door?
And is it the brains and the brawn? I mean, is that what makes you different from bodybuilders?
Well, I am not that different from bodybuilders. I think most bodybuilders even aren't that different from most other human beings. People regard bodybuilding as a subject so extreme, so irrational, that they have no clue why anyone would do that. But if you think about it, it's really not that irrational at all. Bodybuilding is about embracing a so-called lifestyle, in mm-hmm. which we all do as human beings. The clothes you wear, the furniture you buy for your apartment, the house you drive, the home you buy or the apartment you buy, they're all emblems of the self. Who but a bodybuilder knows about projecting that self and foisting it upon the rest of the world?
Well, reading your book, and I understand exactly what you're saying, but at the same time, the extreme obsession, and you really write about the obsession of bodybuilding, I think does make it slightly different than other people who are as egocentric and narcissistic as everybody else. But this obsession and this focus on body is different.
The focus on body is different. I don't think the obsession's different. Take a man who makes money. Money and muscles, very similar. Two incremental self-measures of worth. In bodybuilding, the difference is that your body is everything. Mm-hmm. In money, it's not everything. It becomes, in a man's obsession or a woman's obsession for it, it can become everything. But in bodybuilding, it's all body.
Is there any way to be a bodybuilder and not be obsessed about it?
Not an incredibly successful one, no. On the other hand, if you want to be Donald Trump, don't expect to have a nice home life. Mm-hmm. Huge sacrifices have to be made if you're going to be successful at just about anything.
You talk about it, or other people talk about it, and this is kind of in the beginning of your career as a bodybuilder, the disease. I mean, that's the phrase you use. Why?
The disease I call a complete commitment to all matters pertaining to iron, not just lifting weights, but reading about them. The food you eat, it's all bodybuilding food, protein powders, amino packs. The hours you sleep, you have to get 10 or 12 good hours a night. The jobs you take, you work as a personal trainer in order to work out in the morning, work out at night. It's all emblems of the disease.
Did you feel when you were bodybuilding that you had a disease, or did you have another way of explaining
it? Oh, absolutely, I felt I had a disease. People don't realize that much about bodybuilding is camp. It is artifice raised to an amazing extreme so that bodybuilders chuckle at themselves. Most of the best bodybuilders in the world realize, on the one hand, they've developed a carapace of armor, which is really menacing to other human beings. On the other hand, many of the best ones realize this is absurd. It's a hilarious parody of what it means to be a man. But as long as that's it, let's play with it.
You say that you, after graduating from Oxford University, moved to New York City, found yourself really frightened. I mean, frightened by the city. What do you think was so scary?
I felt absolutely under siege. I felt I felt absolutely out of control. For 7 years, I'd been at college, and every day all I did was read and study, and that's what I loved. I was sequestered in a little lonely room, and I was absolutely rewarded for it academically. As soon as I came out of college and decided, well, I don't really know if I want to become a college professor or not, I was in New York City, I was working at a job I didn't particularly like, and I no longer had any emblems of status. I didn't have any money. I had a sublet apartment. I had nothing, I felt, including no self-control.
You describe yourself, you're tall, and you were always had been a kind of skinny, tall
kid.
Yeah,
Tony Perkins lookalike.
What made you think, and you really talk about seeing a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's interesting to me that you hadn't seen pictures of bodybuilders before, but there was something, even a moment, in a bookstore where you said, that's my solution. That's the solution to my problem.
I did think that. I looked at that kind of body, and I thought, what could possibly perturb this man? Here are muscles in the shape of mountains on that body. His biceps are biceps, true, but they're also bulging Mount Everest biceps. First of all, how does a guy like that buy clothes? That was an immediate interest.
Right.
And then second of all, how could a guy like that possibly be hurt by anything or anyone? How could someone like that feel humiliated if his girlfriend told him, God, I really don't like you very much? Would he cry? I don't think so. Not the kind of Arnold I projected.
So you were seeing the muscles as a kind of suit of armor. Interesting, both against the kind of physical world, but also against the hurts of the emotional
Certainly.
World.
Think of a lobster's carapace. There's a great red lobster, and he's formed by medieval armor. I wanted something which was absolutely impermeable, which would not let other people touch me. I wanted to be, let's use a cartoon image for a cartoon world. I wanted to be a fortress of solitude. I wanted Superman's private preserve, where I could impress everyone a great deal, but inside not be touched.
Tell us about the first time you went into a weight room. What did you see?
I saw a great dichotomy, a split right down the middle of the room. On the one side of the room were the men, most of them scrawny number two pencil necks, who used the universal weight machines and the Nautilus machines. On the other side were the free weight sector group, a rowdy, absolute camouflage-wearing band of men who wore T-shirts that said things like, don't bark if you can't growl.
Was there anything enjoyable about that first day?
The enjoyable thing was I started. I'd done it. It's like a boxer finally getting into the ring. Okay, like the first day of school. Great trepidation involved, but finally you've done it.
Well, I'll say that my small smile here is just that when I walk by a Nautilus room at an aerobics place, and I see people, men and women, sweating out there, I look in and I say, I don't understand. I don't understand the attraction. I don't understand what brings these people to this room over and over and over again.
One of the reasons is sex. If you don't like to go to bars, you can go to gyms and you can find people who you might well want to take home and make love with.
Although you describe in your years of building yourself up that you actually didn't have a lot of girlfriends. I mean, it seemed as if sex took a real backseat to your own body. I guess your own body was more important than another person's body.
It was. I tell people that my process in the gym was a matter of de-evolution. I started off as just simple Sam, who I am. That then changed to Samson. Took about 30 pounds in 2 years. I became Samson, who was muscle man. Mm. Samson was okay for about 2 years more, 30 more pounds, till I was about 240. Then I was Samosaurus, a half-man, half-dinosaur hybrid. From there, I finally became a He-Man Masters of the Universe life-action doll, and I was recognized as such by school children on a playground. I was tanning before my last contest. They came up to me. I heard whispering above me. My eyes were closed. I felt the sun on my back. And then I heard the word, Skeletor. He's Skeletor, as if I was a life-action doll. I became a He-Man doll in such a way that the only women eventually I was interested in dating were she-women, ditzy, girly-girl equivalents of my masculine image.
You actually have a funny but sort of a sad scene of yourself and a woman bodybuilder whose name just escaped me. You can say
G-spot. G-spot. Are we allowed to say that on the air?
How could I have forgotten? Where you actually, we don't need to get too graphic here, but tried to make love with her, and it was as if, and it was a pretty funny description about these two, I guess, she people, trying to embrace. I mean, it was almost like, iron lip against iron lip.
Yeah, think of the Monitor and the Merrimack during the Civil War, two great ironclad vessels that were very much about menace and not much about anything else. We embraced. I kissed her and found a mustache hairier than my own.
My guest is Samuel Fussell, and As he just told you, he went to Oxford University, and a number of years ago, when he moved to New York City, he became a bodybuilder, kind of lost himself into the world of bodybuilding, and he's just written a book about those experiences. It's called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. You talk about the kind of simplicity of building your body up. Not that it doesn't take a long time and there isn't a lot of discipline involved, but there is this kind of cause and effect. I mean, if you do this, then you're going to get some muscles where you want them. Were you attracted to that? And you mentioned the control, the idea that you could go into this room and for once be in some control over your life.
I loved it. I loved the fact that not only was it about reinvention as a human being, but it was also about something which you don't often find in the workplace. In the workplace, you can be very diligent, very industrious, and work 75-hour weeks and be incredibly competent at your job, but it doesn't guarantee promotion. Your boss might not like you, or might be sleeping with someone who's working with you who's incompetent, and promote them. The gym isn't like that. You put in the time, you eat right, you diet properly, you put in your hours, you get stronger, and you get bigger. It absolutely works.
It was interesting, and I was reading an article, I think, that your mother wrote about you as you were building your body up, and this was an article in Lear's magazine, and she said that the larger you got, the smaller that she felt. What effect did this have on your parents, who I will add are both, I guess, college professors, considered to be part of the intellectual crowd, we can say that?
Well, on one hand, my mother was disgusted. I remember submitting my tape of Pumping Iron, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie tour, and she said, "This is disgusting of these men. These men have tits." And I tried to explain to her mother, this is physical development. She said, "Yes, and meanwhile, they're functionally illiterate." So she hated that side of it, and she thought that I was becoming a beast. But
this gets back to your idea about I guess, growing up in an intellectual family. It seems that bodybuilding would be the opposite of what your family wanted for you.
It was. But I always realized that I could do something in bodybuilding. I also knew that Hunter Thompson had written a book called Hell's Angels, which I loved. And I knew that no one had written a book on bodybuilding and that I could do it. I knew I'd have to live it, but that was fine because I loved living it. I thought, okay, if I bodybuild for the next 50 years, I'm never going to stop writing books. I'll always be able to get books out of it.
Sam Fussell is my guest. His book about his 4-year obsession with bodybuilding is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Samuel Wilson Fussell, and he's just written a book called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder, and it's about his years building up his body and the people he met, the experiences he had, and some of the psychological involvements with this whole process that he went through. As you were building up your body, tell us what your life was like. I mean, how did you spend your day? And I guess we're still in New York now.
In New York, I started still holding a job. I thought I was naive enough to believe that I was capable of holding a 9-to-5 job and work out as a bodybuilder. That soon changed. The demands are very high, and I realized that after about 6 months of not getting any sleep, that I had to choose. People become Mr. Olympias not by holding down full-time jobs, but by becoming full-time bodybuilders. So immediately I realized, after the first few months, I would have to eat differently, and that included 5,000 to 7,500 calories a day. It included 10 raw eggs a day. It included all kinds of chicken breasts, pounds of meat. Unbelievable.
And that's expensive. I mean, if you're going to...
It is expensive. That's why you don't have girlfriends when you do it, because you can't afford to take them out on dates.
Well, how much would you spend a week on food? I mean, do you remember?
I'd say about $200 a week.
For an individual person?
For an individual person. And then if you're making, as I was at, I won't say where, $13,000 a year, you can't afford anything else other than your rent.
So how do you support yourself?
Then you become a personal trainer. You move to California and train the wacky and the weird, which is just what I did.
You talk about the walk, I mean, yeah. The bodybuilder's walk. And I think we know what that looks like, those of us that have seen bodybuilders. How did your attitude or even your persona change? I mean, how did you become this person you were inventing for yourself?
Yeah, it's a very complex question. It gets down to Norman Mailer's Advertisements for Myself. I learned the walk from my two friends, gym friends, Sweepy and Mousy, and I realized from the beginning it was a fantastic way to become living theater, to be animated motion of what it means to be menacing.
And for people that aren't familiar with the walk, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as that particular weightlifter's waddle known among the bodybuilding cognoscenti. The thighs are flared outward to prevent inner thigh chafing because the thighs are so big.
Right.
The arms are swept way out to the side because the massivity of your lats or your back necessitates, presumably in theory, that your elbows be as high up as your shoulders. So you look like an enormous turkey with his breast way out strutting as a peacock around the world.
You also look like, and I'm not trying to insult you here, but you look like a pinhead. I mean, the odd thing I find about bodybuilders is that the body gets built up, but you can't add to the head.
Oh, and bodybuilders love that. They want their head to look absolutely tiny. I was actually called in the gym Zippy the Pinhead because my shoulders got so big my head looked like a pea balanced on the middle of a ruler.
But why? I mean, what's
because
beautiful
this isn't this isn't about the glorification of the head or the mind. This is about head decapitation. If you want to look like the Belvedere Apollo, you don't care what's above the neck. You just care what's down. Bodybuilders, many of them pride themselves in not being so good looking. Lots of people can inherit cheekbones. Very few people can make muscles. That's the way they view it.
How easy was it to get steroids?
It was as easy as asking. But steroids are an enormous controversy right now, and unfortunately, steroids are here to stay. The problem now is that we've developed for ourselves a ludicrous situation in which everyone is forced to lie. The competitors are forced to risk their health, and everyone else profits other than some of the competitors. Take in track and field a meat promoter. The meat promoter wants to make money. To make money, you want world records set, or else you're not going to get a full house. To set world records, it helps for the athletes to take every advantage they can in order to get those world records, which have been broken on steroids anyway. So it's a huge vicious cycle.
What then did steroids do for you? Where did steroids take you?
Steroids took me faster than I would have gone without them. They got me what I wanted. What I wanted to do was to compete and to become a bodybuilder and do it as fast as possible. It took me 4 years to look like one of the guys in the magazines. It takes most people 8 or 10 years.
And were you getting double doses?
I was getting, there are no double doses because there's no norm. If you're alive and you're taking steroids, you're succeeding. That's the way the bodybuilding people think it. If your system's capable of taking it, then keep on taking it. It's amazing how much people pack it in.
And the side effects? How did you deal with those?
The side effects I had were acne. I did have a ton of that. I did have rectal bleeding. I had tons of nosebleeds. But the thing about steroids is there are no guarantees. There are thousands of people who have taken them with seemingly no side effects, or side effects like acne, which they view as something purely temporary. The side effects I had were purely temporary. When I went off, the side effects went off.
It's interesting to me that you wanted to build your body up, and yet you didn't mind it covered with acne. I don't want to get obsessed on this, but that's an interesting...
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
When you bodybuild and you are covered with acne, you don't see it on stage because you buy for $25 a quart, you buy gallon jugs of fake tan. As long as you cover yourself with this veneer, the judges can't see the acne. The only people you really want to care about you are the judges in the bodybuilding shows. Providing you look... You can look like Moby Dick off-season, being a tremendous fat man. But you might not care unless for 90 seconds a year when you're on stage, the judges don't see you as a fat man.
My guest is Samuel Fussell. His book is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. It's about his years building up his body and the world of bodybuilding, and also for him, some of the psychological issues that he was struggling with as he was creating this, as you say, this kind of suit of armor for yourself. When did you want to, was the goal then of all this to compete? I mean, is that the goal, that was the goal for you from the beginning?
Yeah. Arnold Schwarzenegger had won Mr. Universe in 5 years. Yeah. I thought, okay, if he's done it in 5 years, if I work as hard as anyone who's ever worked at this, why can't I do it in 5 or maybe 4? And by the time I'd done 4, the next year I would have done the Mr. America show, and the logical sequence from that is doing the Mr. Universe show. And I realized after my 4th year, forget it. If this is what it means to do it, I don't want it. I want to be a human being. I don't want to be superhuman.
Well, how did your routine change as you then went into competition?
It's called the contest countdown, where you break down everything in the day in order to win in a contest. So my diet changed from going from 7,500 calories a day to just 1,000 calories a day. For a 260-pound man, 1,000 calories a day or 750 calories a day is a matter of rice cakes and water. That's eating almost nothing.
So your body's starting to eat itself.
Oh, that's the whole point. It does eat itself. But providing it eats its fat first and not its muscle, then you're fine on stage. The problem once you're on stage is that you have so little energy left that while you're swiveling and growling and preening and posing, you're about to collapse and black out because you're so dizzy. But the point isn't to be healthy inside. It's to look like the image of self-health to the judges. It's also about to look like you're in control.
At one point, and this is really at the very end of your career, you got your, I guess you were eating about 630 calories a day. I mean, this was sort of training for the big event.
Yeah.
And you could hardly even make it to the event. I mean, you were so
I could
weak.
Literally not even walk. I did two contests in 2 weeks. There was a 1 week break between each. In the first contest, I was about 8 pounds overweight, and I realized it on stage. I won the show. I won my weight class, but I was a little hefty. And in bodybuilding circles, they call it smoother than a glass mirror. Mm. You couldn't see enough veins, the vascularity look that's prized among bodybuilders. So I realized I needed to lose at least 8 to 10 pounds. So in 6 days, I lost 12 pounds. And I did that by sitting on the sofa or lying down on the sofa, practically comatose, and not eating a great deal, eating almost all down to 500 calories a day. I was so weak, I couldn't even practice my posing. I couldn't get up. I didn't go to the bathroom for the whole week because my body was feeding on itself.
Do you think you were losing your mind?
No, I think I was doing exactly what I wanted to do. And that's what it took to do it. For people to think that bodybuilders don't do that, bodybuilders are lying when they say they don't do that because they're trying to sell their product to the public. They're trying to say, oh, this is great. It's about health. Ha!
And where did your muscles go? You still have some. I mean, I can see that.
They atrophied. And another muscle cliche, you don't lose it, you lose it. Mm. And the hard part is if you've been evolving and you see yourself evolving from a 17-inch collar to an 18 to a 20, all of a sudden you go back down to an 18 to a 17 and you're wearing the same shirts you were wearing 5 or 6 years ago. The trick is thinking, gosh, I hope I'm not the same person I was 6 years ago. And you're not. But if you just lead your life according to measurements and inches, then that's where you're always going to be. It's an endless rut.
I'm curious where then the pain that drove you to this sense of feeling afraid in the world, of feeling vulnerable, what happened to that?
I decided to face it.
Did you?
I got so tired of erecting the proscenium and the facade. It was Baroque. It was Rococo. It was so complex. It was such stage scenery. I spent so many hours per day hoisting it and working the ratchets and the levers. I didn't want to do it anymore. I'd much rather just face it. If it means having to be humiliated and having to bear insults, fine. I'm willing to do that. Just don't force me to go to the weight room and make me mouth the cliches and look like Superman. Don't want to do that anymore.
And you still work out some?
I won't work out for 6 months at a time. If I have to let off some steam, I'll go in, renew old acquaintances, and do a few times a week. But I'm no longer a prisoner to it, thank God. And I love those who do. I love to watch it. I just don't want to be one of them anymore.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Sam Fussell's book is called Muscle, Confessions of an Unlikely Bodybuilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moscowane with Fresh Air. As a kid with diabetes, Jeff Weinstein's world revolved around food. It turns out food is still a big factor in Weinstein's life. He grew up to be the food critic for The Village Voice. Coming up, we talk with Jeff Weinstein. Also, in the last few years, the saxophone quartet has gone from a relatively rare type of jazz ensemble to a much more popular form. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead begins a two-part look at some of the leading sax quartets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. and U.N. officials are hopeful that a final agreement can be reached with Iraq to allow a police force to enter the country. Such a force might help convince Kurdish refugees that it's safe to return to their homes. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
The police force under consideration would be small, 400 to 500 lightly armed men, according to UN and Iraqi officials. Details are still being worked out, but Iraq's UN ambassador said yesterday he was confident that final agreement would come within a week. The police obviously would not be able to repel an Iraqi assault against the Kurdish population, but they're not expected to. Rather, they would create a buffer to minimize Iraqi-Kurdish friction. The police would also serve as a tripwire. If Saddam Hussein did send his troops to overrun the police, he would invite a much bigger international response. Finally, the police could serve as observers, helping to keep Iraqi forces on good behavior. The Bush administration has encouraged Iraq to agree to the police force in the hope that such a force will allow Allied troops to turn over their relief operations in northern Iraq to the United Nations at last. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Secretary of State Baker says that there has been some progress in setting up Middle Eastern peace talks. After holding three rounds of talks with Israeli Prime Minister Shamir, Baker will meet again tomorrow with the Prime Minister. However, Israeli Foreign Minister Levy says that it's still up to the Arab states to prove their intentions, and it's up to Baker to gauge Arab sentiments. However, U.S. officials say that Baker plans to fly home tomorrow. A comprehensive energy bill moving quickly through the Senate has run into trouble. The Senate Energy Committee failed to reach a consensus over whether to require automakers to build cars that get better gasoline mileage. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Without provisions that will save energy, Senator Bennett Johnston's bill, which also includes provisions to boost energy production, doesn't stand much of a chance. Today, Johnston tried to strike middle ground, proposing to require the auto industry to make cars that get 37 miles per gallon by the year 2006. Republicans on the committee said it would be too onerous. It would kick Detroit when it's already down. Democrats argued it doesn't go far enough. The fight is typical of the controversy brewing in Congress over how best to solve the nation's dependence on foreign oil. Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota.
You got some people say, well, you can't do anything on the production side. You got some people say, well, you can't do anything on a fuel economy side. I mean, what are we going to do?
Tomorrow, the committee will vote on whether to allow oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 21 points to close at 2,865.38 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. According to an advisory panel, the FDA does not have the authority, leadership, or facilities to protect public health. A panel set up by Health and Human Services Secretary Sullivan said it found the agency is overextended and underfunded. The advisory panel concluded that the FDA needs more money and power within the federal government in order to do its job. While Sullivan welcomed this report, he rejected a recommendation that the FDA be moved from the Public Health Service and made a stronger independent agency within the Department of Health and Human Services. In Yugoslavia, ethnic conflicts have helped create a power vacuum, with the leadership failing to elect a new chief of the collective federal presidency. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli has more on the story.
Leaders of the country's six republics and two autonomous provinces met in Belgrade today for what was supposed to be a formality, the prearranged transfer of power from a Serb to a Croatian in the country's top post, according to an annual rotation system. But Serbia succeeded in blocking the election of the Croatian Stipe Mesic and plunged Yugoslavia into the worst constitutional crisis in its history. As of midnight, the country has no chief of state. The federal presidency is the supreme commander of the Yugoslav army, and the failure to elect a new chief has raised fears that the armed forces could intervene to fill the power vacuum. Croatia is moving toward independence and wants a loose confederation of sovereign states, while Serbia claims only the current federation can safeguard the rights of the minority Serb population in Croatia. This is Silvia Poggioli in Zagreb.
Inventories moved down 0.8% in March, an amount that was twice the drop of the month before. One reason for the slide was a sharp cutback by car dealers, who trimmed their stocks 3.7%. The Commerce Department says that business sales were off 1% in March. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I've always fantasized that being a restaurant or movie critic would be the perfect job. What doesn't enter into my reveries are all the bad movies and lousy meals that would come with the territory. My guest, Jeff Weinstein, is food critic for The Village Voice. Although he'll cover the latest downtown trendy restaurant, he also writes about the role food plays in our daily lives. Weinstein was a juvenile diabetic, and he says his interest in food began when he was a kid.
When I was young, my mother had to measure and weigh everything I ate, had to think very carefully balancing meals, and had to incorporate my diet into the rest of the family's diet. And I was also, insulin makes you hungry.
Does it?
Yeah. People don't talk about that very much, but it when it comes on, you get an appetite that is overwhelming sometimes. And when I was younger, I often felt hungry.
Would you say, is it cravings that you get?
Yeah, you get a craving for food, and you have to satisfy it. I think that all of this together, the kind of consciousness of the importance of food and the fact that I had to eat on time and eat carefully, made me both anxious about it and interested in it.
I would think as a diabetic, though, there are certain things you just can't eat without paying some kind of consequence for it.
Well, I eat everything.
Do you?
I just have to be very careful about how much of it I eat. I taste everything, certainly. It's a question of balance and timing more than a question of what you eat. I eat sugar. I eat fat. I don't like eating large amounts of it. I'm eating less meat now, but I have to I love meat. I love the taste of it, but I think it's better for me to eat less of it. And I sometimes tell people that if they're interested. They may not be.
Right. Tell me a little bit about the food that you grew up with. Maybe not so much the food that was prepared especially for you, but I think for children and for parents, and I'm speaking here very personally, food is a very loaded issue. And I know I grew up in a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant family. My husband is Jewish. And the approach to food is entirely different. I mean, the food on the plate that I grew up with didn't touch. The food on the plate that he grew up with was piled high with stuff.
That's a wonderful image. My father was Jewish. My mother was not, but converted to marry. What that meant is that she tried very hard to learn how to cook Jewish with some success. Uh-huh. But both my father and my mother liked both to cook and to eat was Italian food. We lived in Brooklyn. This is in the 50s. So if there was real cooking going on, it was either fresh seafood, which my father loved, or really, really good Sicilian-type red sauce cooking, because all of our neighbors were Italian, and we all ate with them and had a good time. The other thing, though, that influenced me was we went out to eat a lot, especially my father liked to take my brother and myself just as a way of being with us. And he sometimes did business in restaurants. In fact, he ran one, but this is before I was born. And they were all Italian restaurants. And I'm afraid I have I'm imprinted with stuffed artichokes and grilled veal chops. So I can't get them out of my head.
So food was not necessarily a loaded issue, but it was a communal family time.
There were always tensions. If my mother and father were fighting, it was clearly being fought over dinner at the dinner table. If my father was working late, he wasn't there. One of the things that was interesting that I've forgotten about is that the 50s, which is when I grew up, a very interesting time for women who were trained mostly to cook and to cook from scratch to move into using canned, especially frozen food. And I remember the day my mother finally got a freezer. And we went to the new Waldbaum's, so this is in 56 or 57, and bought every kind of frozen food that we could afford and tried them out. And then TV dinners. We were the first.
And the rest is history, of course.
The rest is history. TV dinners trained me about the price you pay for convenience and the promise of the unfulfilled promise of the capitalist dream.
My guest is Jeff Weinstein. He's the food critic for The Village Voice. Some of his columns have been collected in a book called Learning to Eat. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Food critic Jeff Weinstein is my guest. You don't believe in the kind of rating system. You don't give restaurants 4 stars. And you even say in your book that you don't even like to use adjectives when you're talking about a restaurant.
Well, yeah, I may be changing my mind about some of this because people, not about ratings. I don't think I'll ever be forced to rate a restaurant.
What's wrong with that?
Well,
what'd you say?
I think it appeals to the need of people to be told what to do. And I don't think that it's my job to perpetuate a kind of you know and I don't attitude. I want people to enjoy what I write, to I'm not going to use the word empowerment, but to empower people to go out and figure stuff out for themselves, to be critical, to enjoy what a restaurant is about. Now, I do evaluate restaurants, but not with a rating. The rating seems to... Why are highly rated restaurants, the ones that are given four... I don't know what the ratings are here, 4 or 5 tokes, you know, chef's hats or stars or forks, whatever garbage the newspaper wants to use.
Well, it's a shorthand, isn't it?
Yeah, but why are they always French? Why, you know, why or almost always, maybe one hotsy-totsy Italian, why are they always expensive? What does the rating mean? Hmm. I've found in talking to other very serious colleagues, very good and serious other restaurant critics, that even sometimes they're a little confused about what goes into a rating, what proportion is service and atmosphere, what proportion is food, what proportion is satisfaction. Ratings tend to guarantee satisfaction.
Well, I would think, too, if you have a rating system, then no one's going to read your writing. And it sounds like you're more interested in the writing.
Writer. That's the second part of it. I think that I've never proposed myself as a rater. Mm-hmm. I'm a writer. And people, I understand. I like ratings. I mean, I look at the stars. You know, I mean, everybody does. It appeals to something really silly. But I don't think that's a good way for people to either be instructed about where to eat. Luckily, we also have little boxes with information. That's very important information. And if they read what I write, I hope, I mean, I eat 3 times in a restaurant mm-hmm. before I write about it, if it's a big restaurant. And I will evaluate the food. And I will tell people what may be better than, you know, what's better than what isn't on the menu.
What do you look for, though? And if you come across a restaurant that you think is very good. Mm-hmm. What qualifications?
Well, first, it's a gut feeling that I'm being. It's hospitality is the for me one of the most important things. Not just if somebody's smiling at me when I walk in, but a feeling like somebody wants to feed people, mm-hmm. wants to open a restaurant, make people happy through cooking. You can feel it. Very often you can feel it. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you're surprised.
And you can usually feel that rather quickly,
yeah,
don't you think?
Yeah, I think people know. They know people are very smart, and they know when they're being taken advantage of. They also are very smart and know when they're being genuinely welcomed, not just for their pocketbooks. You know, I know that feeling now, mm-hmm. and it's a treasure. Now, if it's backed up by real food, you know, it's nice to have the feeling, and if you can't eat it, it's not as much fun. But if you have a combination of the two, then you're in good shape.
So you really start with the feeling, the feeling of comfortableness that people like to mm-hmm. cook. They want to feed you.
Right.
They want.
That's always connected to competence. Mm-hmm. And if a restaurant is incompetent, either in the front of the house with the waiters and the people who greet you at the door, or in the kitchen, no amount of hospitality is going to work. And I find that the two are usually connected.
I'm wondering, do you get, as a restaurant critic, the sort of restaurant critic's version of writer's block, where you kind of just plain lose your appetite? Your taste buds just aren't as sharp as they sometimes are?
Yeah, no, and it's once a year it happens to me. I get overwhelmed. I don't want another meal. I can't eat it. I want it fast. I have to. I can't bear the idea of dealing with another waiter, waitress, table, check situation. And I take a week off.
Is that right?
If I can afford it. and the newspaper understands that. They're very good about it. But I can't do that too often. Most of the time, I figured it's a great job. You have to eat anyway. Let's do it. But a writer's block is another problem, actual writer's block. The writing is many years as I've been doing it, and it's 20 years now, it's still a total torture to sit down and to consider the reader but not consider the reader too much, to try to satisfy yourself, to make a deadline, and to make sure that you're really careful about it. It's a tremendous responsibility. You can damage a restaurant in ways that you never even imagined. So you've got to be careful.
If you feel you're going to have that kind of effect, perhaps you even see a restaurant that's struggling, do you just keep your mouth shut?
Yeah, sure. Also, in New York, you don't review a restaurant that's too small because you will overwhelm them with business and do as much damage that way as you can by panning. What you do in that case is you link them, little ones, together. And so it's like cutting the thousands of people that might go because they read you, which is lovely. But it cuts it down into a group. I once suggested, in fact, that, as a joke, of course, that people with last names that began from A to E should go on Monday, from F to, et cetera. It didn't work.
I often play games with friends, not games, but just talk about memorable meal experiences, things that...
This is the reason I write about food. It's connected to everything you do, everything you feel. It's not a little pleasure that's on the side of important stuff. I wish it were on the front page of every newspaper instead of somewhere in the so-called women's pages. It's not little. The fact that I recommend restaurants, to tell you the truth, is sometimes just an excuse to write about why I think food is important. And sometimes my columns are not only about restaurants. They are about memory. They are about love and love and food connection. They are about mutual responsibility. I mean, everybody, if a world can't feed people and can't feed them with pleasure, there's no, then it's failing. And I think that that's happening in a lot of where we live. And everything I like about living and everything I think is important can be connected to food. And even at its even as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But I think actually it's more than a metaphor. It's real. And I like that it brings, you look at an apple, you look at an orange, you look at anything, just a little thing. And if you look at it hard enough and you figure out who made it, where did it come from, how did it get to you, what will you do with it, the whole world starts entering into food.
Jeff Weinstein is food critic for The Village Voice.
Don't cook me up no fancy line. Cook me a dinner. Cook me a dinner, and if everything is tasty, I believe in letting you know. A lot of ladies think a little romance, that'll really be all you need. You eat your cooking, you take a chance. Don't feed me whiskey, gin, and wine. Cook me a dinner. Cook and serve me something tasty to chew, and maybe I realize that all I'm really longing for is you. My, what a delicious looking pudding. Let me have a little bite. My, you really taking care of business tonight. Really got the parts on this evening. What a meal, what a meal, what a meal, what a meal. Nowadays, such an awful women never learn. The art of our new burn. Don't cook up where we'll go to dine. Cook me a dinner. Them fancy restaurants, they really are cold. They really ain't no soul. They can't duplicate the cook at home. The home is soul food. Soulful food. That'll get it every doggone.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. What you got on the show today, Robert?
Well, Marty, we'll have news today of the United Nations and Iraq trying to establish a UN police force in the north of the country, where so many Kurdish refugees are returning to their homes now. Also, part two of Brenda Wilson's series on women and AIDS, a story about some of the doctors who treat women who have the disease. We'll also be talking with a Canadian journalist who has interviewed Mohammed Al-Mashat. Remember him? He was the Iraqi ambassador to Washington, and he was on our program and many others throughout the war with Iraq. He has now sought and been given asylum in Canada.
Okay. Robert, thanks. Those stories and more are coming up later on All Things Considered. 15 years ago, you could count the number of jazz saxophone quartets on one or two fingers. Then the World Saxophone Quartet and Rova came along, and the floodgates opened. Nowadays, there are sax quartets everywhere, from Seattle to New Orleans to Washington, D.C. to Amsterdam. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead samples new albums by three of them.
That's the World Saxophone Quartet, accompanied by a trio of African drummers, on their appropriately titled new album, Metamorphosis. A year and a half ago, the group made its first personnel change after 13 years together. Alto saxophonist Julius Hempel was kicked out, and Arthur Blythe came in to replace him. It was a risky move. Hempel was the band's principal composer. But so far, it's worked out okay. Blythe's razor-keen alto sound gives the ensemble a cleaner edge, and while he's never been a prolific composer, his riffy little tunes are ready-made for this band. They give the musicians lots of interpretive leeway and catchy melodic hooks. Blythe wrote the title track for Metamorphosis. It makes conceptual sense for the World Saxophone Quartet to play with African percussionists. Modern sax quartets owe as much to polyrhythmic African drum choirs as they do to the silky harmonizing of big band sax sections or classical string quartets. The drummers make the band sound more lively than they have in a long time. The move makes commercial sense, too. With saxophone quartets sprouting up all over the place, it's getting harder for established groups to set themselves apart from the competition. The long-running 29th Street Saxophone Quartet also has a new album out called Underground. That group includes alto saxophonist Bobby Watson, one of the most animated bebop players around. But the band shows off its rhythmic snap even when he's not out front. If you're looking for the swingin'est sax quartet, this is it, no contest. The alto soloist there is Ed Jackson. In concert, the 29th Street Quartet has a lot of visual appeal. They jump around on stage, physically as well as musically, regrouping into duos and trios. That sort of excitement doesn't translate to record. So to punch up their new album, they've brought along some guests. Flugelhorn player Yu Masekela, a rhythm section, and a vocalist. Unfortunately, in their case, more equals less. Singer Pamela Watson has a lot of enthusiasm, but she sounds more influenced by Laura Nero or Carole King than by jazz singers.
You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night blazing their light can hold a candle to your dazzle, dazzle. You got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride. I got butterflies inside. I want to cry, want to croon, and laugh like a loon. It's that old devil moon in your eyes.
The new kid on the block among reed choirs is Your Neighborhood Saxophone Quartet. They're a scrappy but spirited bunch from Boston who record for a Dutch label, Coppens. Everyone in that band composes too, but I like them best when they play other folks' music. Their latest album, Boogie Stop Shuffle, contains covers of tunes by Charles Mingus, the Dizzy Gillespie Big Band, and the Godfather of Soul. This is James Brown's I'll Go Crazy. Among the other oddball pieces on Your Neighborhood Saxophone Quartet's latest album is a version of Fate in a Pleasant Mood by big band leader Sun Ra. Their next CD, due out this summer, will be entirely devoted to Sun Ra tunes. These guys keep reminding you that sax quartets don't have a limited range, which is the reason four saxophonists would start playing without accompaniment in the first place. Besides these three groups, the other leading sax quartet is California's Rova. I'll play you some of their stuff next time.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed new albums by the World Saxophone Quartet, the 29th Street Saxophone Quartet, and these guys, Your Neighborhood Saxophone Quartet. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl and directed by Chris Spurgeon. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-8. Talbots. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, animal trainer Vicky Hearn comes to the defense of so-called dangerous dogs. And we meet Australian filmmaker Mark Lewis. His new movie, The Wonderful World of Dogs, is an irreverent and hilarious documentary about man's best friend. That and more on the next Fresh Air.